You're listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California.
Well, this is fun. Have you been interviewed recently?
Tony Mobley.
Oh, that's right. That was last year. I looked at that for a while.
Yeah.
I love Tony. He's like the guy you want to have as the pilot in the plane as both engines catch fire and you're going down, and Tony's calm.
Very calm.
Calm voice is there saying, "We've lost both engines, but I'm sure we can work something out between here and hitting the ground." Is winging it okay for this, or do you have something very specific in mind?
That's all we have to do is wing it.
Okay.
I mean, we don't have any other option, man. If I had a script, I'd rip it up. All right. So let's start with you doing the opening credits. So okay. I'll do the opening credits so you can see what I do, and then you can do something similar.
Okay.
Hello, listeners. So glad you could join us today. My name is Lois Richter, and the program is That's Life. And today is my guest. Well, it's me.
Okay. Hello, listeners. You're listening to That's Life on KDRT. I'm your host, Lois Richter.
No, you're not.
I sound a little funny. It's because I'm not Lois. My name is Mitch Hill. And today I'm going to interview Lois, which is a nice turn of the tables, so to speak, because Lois doesn't get the opportunity to talk very much about herself. That's what today's show is going to be about, me talking to Lois, asking her questions that you probably have been wondering and pondering. What is this lady and what is she doing here? And that's what my life is all about. So we're going to find out together. Lois, are you up for this?
I am up for this, Mitch. It was so good to interview you a week ago or so, and I'm happy to have the tables turned on me.
I am your guest host. I'm the guy that's going to be asking the questions, and I'll try to keep this interesting, provocative. And as I always say when I interview somebody or I get interviewed, you're going to find out a couple of things you never knew about this person, and they have never admitted anywhere else. So stay tuned for those Easter eggs. It should be extraordinary and fun. Or I just might crash and burn and be horrible, and that might provide some sort of entertainment in itself. It's always fun that way. So, Lois, here you are on the other side of the table on your radio station, KDRT, which I think you referred to as The Dirt. Are we allowed to say that?
K-Dirt, yeah.
K-Dirt. All right, I like that. That's very natural and grainy and macular or whatever. So, Lois, since you're the person being interviewed, and I know Lois, I have to tell you, first of all, mainly because of our relationship on Office Hours, which is a program that Lois and I are panelists on, along with some other people. And I've learned a lot about Lois just being there with her and watching her in action when she answers all these technical questions or philosophical questions. And the more I hear her answer questions, the more I want to know about her. Because, Lois, I consider you one of the most interesting people that I know for a lot of reasons. She just hugged herself and said, "Isn't that nice of him?"
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
and what's interesting is that you do so many different things. And I probably don't know the half of them, so I'm here to learn along with the listeners some of the things that you do that we don't know about. Now, you've got the bird watching or watching birds with Lois.
That's one.
Did I get that correctly?
Let me go through them. My current five projects are Birding with Lois, which is a brand new live question and answer show with panelists, with some of the crew from Office Hours, and that's going to be weekly. Then I am hosting and playing security for an international Quaker meeting for worship to pray for peace in Ukraine. And that's a daily event, but daily was going to burn us out. So Julie Harlow, who's the clerk of that, and I alternate. So I'm on for 4 days, off for three. Then I have my radio show, which obviously you're here. You know I have a radio show. Then I do I play recordings for my friend's exercise group on Friday morning and afternoon. What was the fifth one?
I don't know. Is it?
Oh, I'm the treasurer for the Davis Friends meeting, so I have to do all this finance stuff.
Do you do something in the educational world?
It depends on what you mean by educational world. I share things with people. Oh, My husband just snuck in and whispered, Davis Garden Show.
Ah, excellent.
I also do a second radio show. Don Shore and I have been doing this for 15 years, and it's called the Davis Garden Show, and he's the plant expert, and I get to ask questions. So I guess I'm up to six. And then, of course, there's taking care of the house and stuff like that.
You do all of those things. So you're a truly emancipated woman. You do it all. You cover both areas.
I'm a little bit of an overachiever. I take on too many things sometimes, but sometimes I need to.
Maybe I should be interviewing your husband a little bit more than that.
Well, if he's willing, I'm willing, but he usually doesn't want to be on the radio.
So what would be the year, the time scale that when you first went on TV?
TV, 1996 was the first, okay. Is when I got training, and 1997 is when I won an award for my first production. I am such an overachiever.
But what motivated you to go into television?
Oh, I didn't go into television. I'm part of my community. I've always been very active in the Davis community. And I heard about this resource where you could give information to the community through this brand new DCTV. And so I went in there to find out how to become a producer so I could do, like, you know, I don't know, announcements or whatever. I wasn't planning to be a television personality or producer or anything. It just happened.
But there you are.
But here I am.
Have you seen the show on TV? It's on HBO Plus called Julia.
No.
It's about Julia Child. Watch it because it's very interesting because you're beginning to describe a little bit of an arc that Julia Child followed to get into the cooking business. It's a little behind the scenes thing. And I kind of visualize how you got into it. And you're a very inquisitive person. I noticed that on Office Hours. And you're not afraid to ask questions, whether it's the arts or birding or technical. And technical things are tough. I know that most people pigeonhole women as being non-technical, but that's not true. You certainly proved that point over and over again. What is your fascination with technology?
That is so assumptive. You say I'm fascinated with technology. I'm not. I'm a user. I mean, it's like I'm not the person. My brother was the person, but I'm not the person who would go under the hood of the car and futz with the engine. I just wanted to be able to turn it on and drive it. And it's like that with a lot of things. I want to be able to use or understand or make logical choices about. And so in order to do that, I need to know about something. And so, in fact, on my radio shows, a lot of times I'll interview someone who is in a particular career where they've got lots of jargon words, and I'll go through and I'll say, oh gee, what does that mean? What does this mean? How do you do that? And if the description is too far over my head, I think it's probably going to be too far over my listeners too. So I'll back off. I'll come down and I say, okay, let's start with basics. You know, what's a dog catcher anyway, or whatever the career is, and we come back.
But you're the first person in there when we do our technical show to ask those questions, and that's impressive quality to have. You're curious.
You mean other people haven't been doing that?
No,
really,
not to the level you are. You're very curious, so you ask.
I'm also very novice, and so I have a lot to learn.
Well, you come across as a highly technical person that's not afraid to ask questions about it, which is interesting because you're using technology to spread the word about your interest. You know, social media is relatively new. Podcasting is relatively new. TV's been around for the last 50 years or so, and radio for at least 100. So you're a little bit into all of those things. Mm-hmm. How do you pick the things, the subject matter that you're most interested in talking about to the public?
I don't. I mean, it isn't a most interested. It isn't like, well, I really want to know about this, so I'll go and search out whoever it is to get all the knowledge and get that professor from campus to come over. It doesn't work that way. I'll be walking down the street and I'll meet someone and we'll start talking. And I'll say, gee, do you want to come on my show and be interviewed and talk to me? So I had this professor who was mycelium mushrooms was his big thing, but I met him when I was birding, and I happened to be chatting with him about what we were seeing out in the woods there. And I said, would you like to be on my show? And he said, well, I'm not an expert birder. I said, that's okay with me. We can talk about it anyway. Are you an expert in something else? He says, mushrooms. I said, great, we'll do a show on mushrooms. So it wasn't that I was wanting mushrooms and went and found him. It was that I found him. And then I was curious about what he did, what he knew, what he would experience. So that's how it happens. It's much less organized than people think it is.
But why birds? Why is that an interest of yours?
They exist.
Well, they do. We exist with them. But
I mean, yeah. It's easier to find out all the species of birds. There's a limited number compared to all the species of flowers. There's a whole lot more, and they keep migrating or mutating or whatever. And so honestly, I met someone when I was working the elections, and she and I worked the same polling place one time, and we got to chatting, and she turned me on to birds. And the next thing I knew, within a couple of weeks, I was on the board of directors on the local Audubon Society. And it's like, I don't know. I just can't say no to people.
So could you describe for the uninitiated what the lifestyle of a typical resident of Davis, California is, and how does that relate to your interest?
Well, being a feminist, I would say that there is no typical. That is to say, giving a broad general term to a person and then assuming that that all of them are going to be the same is not quite That's not quite accurate. But there are a lot of people in Davis who are very interested in ecology, in keeping the planet healthy, and doing whatever we can to make things better. I'm very proud of the fact that my town, my little Davis, California, was one of the first towns ever to get recycling, street pickup of recycling. And that started in the 70s. Well, that was really early. I'm not sure we were the first city, but we was definitely in the first dozen. So things like that feel good. And there's always lots of activity as far as if there's a proposal for changing this street, well, we'll have town meetings about it. If there's a proposal to build a new center or a new subdivision or something like that, there will definitely be people pro and con and debating it all over the place. It's just, we're a very activist community. Not all the people are activists, but the community as a whole has a lot of activity in it. And then, of course, there's the university and the students. And I came here in 68 to be a student at the university. And we started, I say we, the 1968 cohort of students began an incredibly large number of new things. There was the switchboard where people, where students could call in and other students would look up information for them and help them get connected. There was the house where people who were having challenges, either emotionally or something was going on with their family or whatever, they could go and have a place to talk. And there was a lot of the peer-on-peer things that got started in 68. I was very active time. And then in a couple of years, Now, at the same time, the whole world was becoming active. So there was, do you remember something called the Whole Earth Catalog?
Oh, absolutely. That was a classic. Yeah.
And it started in 67 or 8, something like that. And it became a national phenomenon. And then Earth Day was declared in 1970. And they had it, I think it was April 22nd or something like that. It's now Earth Day, but I think around the same time they had this. And so, of course, Davis, being overachievers as we are, we couldn't have an Earth Day celebration. No, no, no. We had to take the whole week. So we had a week-long celebration of that stuff. And the student body, the ASUCD, which is the student body organization, said, okay, we want to do this every year, and we're going to start next year. We're going to do a spring celebration, and we're going to call it the Whole Earth Festival. And they did. So 1971 was the first time that that event had that name. And it has been going ever since. Well, during the pandemic, it didn't happen. But so Earth Day became Earth Week, became Whole Earth Festival, became, well, part of my life. And so for years and years and years, I have assisted in working the Whole Earth Festival and getting it happen and stuff like that. And so there you go. So, you know, that's just a typical Davis person.
Who would you credit with leading you to become a feminist and be so involved in your environment?
So
who or what?
What I think is more appropriate. I grew up in Backwoods, Michigan, and we moved to California at the end of my eighth grade. And then I went to college and Davis. But the fact that I started out in a place where we were so socially backward that you didn't date anyone until you got into high school. I mean, it just didn't happen. You had, you know, gangs of kids running around going sledding or going to the movies or whatever, but it wasn't dating. And then at the end of high school, you got married. I mean, it was a very, very concise little thing back there. I came out here in eighth grade, the end of eighth grade. I had not had a date. We hadn't talked about what do boys do, what do girls do. We hadn't done any of that stuff back there. Came out here. They not only were dating, they'd been going steady for a couple of years. I never did get the training on what's a boy, what's a girl. I missed that whole thing because I moved from there to there. Well, I go to college. So I didn't have anything to unlearn. But at that time in college, and this would have been 68, there were a lot of people talking about roles, gender roles. What can boys do? What can girls do? What restriction? And there were a lot of people saying, it's not right that women are told you can't do that just because you're a girl. That's just not right. We're people. We're people too. And so at that point, it was in the air, and I make friends with folks. And so I made some friends, and I thought about it, and I thought on it and thought on it. And I said, okay, that's right. That's true. We are people. We do need to do things. And so at that time, so there were a lot of people getting together and starting to work. And I joined in on that group. And there was a group of women who were going to form the Women's Center on campus. And the university had said, well, you can have this little temporary building over here. And so we got together, we started doing things. It was growing. And during that year, we started collecting books and papers and things. There was very little written, very, very little. All the things that we got for the library were mostly self-published, you know, little flyers that came out of basements and stuff like that. But the Women's Center was going to have the very first ever discussion about rape. And so they were having a little conference, and we wanted to get the writings that were about that. And at that point, the only book I know couldn't remember at this point, I think it was the only one there, was called Stop Rape Now. And it was from some women in Michigan at a university. They had published it themselves. And so we were going to get some and, you know, make it available for people at the conference and then send back the stuff we didn't want. And we were told by the university, you can't sell anything that you haven't, you have to buy it through the bookstore. Hmm. Okay. All right. So we went to the bookstore, and the bookstore said, fine, you pay for it ahead of time. We'll order it. You can't return it. And we went, but wait a minute. We don't know. But what? And so I, of course, being me, said, there's got to be a way around this. I can always find a way around anything. So I contacted the local radical bookstore in Berkeley. It was called Grandma Books, and it had all the socialists and the radicals and the, you know, and it had feminist stuff, and they had that pamphlet. And so I said, can you send me a box? We need at least, you know, 20 of this pamphlet, and then whatever else you've got that you think would be pertinent to, you know, women's liberation. And so they on the Greyhound, they shipped up a box to me. I went to the conference, set up a table, did the whole thing, ignored the university. And Then when we were done, I shipped the box and sent it back to Berkeley. And we did that a couple of times. And I said, well, this is shipping back and forth is ridiculous. Why don't I just buy a collection of materials that I think people are interested in? Because I was the librarian at the office there. And so I picked out a few things. I had them shipped to my house. I set up a little bookcase in my front living room. And I sold those books to people who were interested in the subject. Eventually, it became Davis Women's Books. That's W-O-M-E-N. Because as we know, women includes men. The language fellows were trying to tell us that, oh, no, you can say men because men includes women. I'm going, you can't spell. Women includes men. Men does not include. Okay, never mind. It's a bad joke anyway. But anyway, so as a student, I ended up with a little tiny bookstore in my house, my rental house, and eventually moved it into a little storefront. One of my friends said, you have to be in a storefront. Shaking her finger just like that. You have to be in a storefront. And I have the savings from my retirement account, because when you work for the city, they always put stuff away for you. And then when you're done, they give it back. And she says, so I can cover the first and last month's rent. I found a space for you. You have to go and be there. And I'm going, well, what can I say? It's like, okay, I guess we're going to have a storefront now. And we did. And it was not paid staff. It made enough money to keep the lights on, keep the doors open, and replace the stock that we sold. And that was it. So I did women's things. I did gay things. I did local artists because there wasn't an outlet for that. Of course, I like science fiction, so I had my favorite science fiction things there. There was no outlet for women's music. Now, women's music, listeners may not even know what the term means, but back in the 70s, it meant women who were singing about women. So it was feminist songs and that sort of thing. Or women who were gay and weren't getting published by regular places. Anyway, so make a long story even longer. We did that for a couple of years until one summer when all of the volunteer staff was graduating and moving away, except for me, I was still there. And it was going to be a really hot fire season. So we decided to shut the store down because I'd be gone off fighting fires and most of the other folks were going off graduating and stuff.
Wait a minute, I got to stop you for a second.
No, one more second. And by that time, we had two bookstores in town that would carry the material we had, and by that time, enough of the feminist material was being published by regular presses that the university would carry it. Now go ask your question.
I was just going to say, you made a little left turn into becoming a firefighter, and I wanted to know a little more about that.
Well, we'll get there.
How did you become a firefighter? I know you're a feminist, and it doesn't necessarily make you an activist, but maybe you were. You might have been a feminist, an activist, and now it turns out you're a firefighter, too.
Yep. Yeah. So what happened with that is that this was a couple of years before we closed the bookstore, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do for the summer, where I was going to work, and I went over to Sacramento where there was a women's center there, and I don't even remember where I was sitting, but I was sitting, I went in to eat my lunch and just hang out on the chairs while I was waiting to, you know, go look for more work. And I happened to be on the chairs, and behind me there was another row of chairs facing the other way, and there was these two women, and they were talking about going and fighting fires. And I thought, ooh, cool. That would be really cool. I had tried to become a firefighter at UC Davis as a student because one of my friends did it, and boy, he got a lot of money for not doing a whole lot of work. And I wanted to do it, but they wouldn't let girls on. And so I had been turned away from that one. But this one, it was okay. And these two women were going to go up. They were going to go up that afternoon to the training class to get on the crew. And I thought, this is exciting. Can I go with you? Sure. Come on along. And so that's what I did. So we drove up there that afternoon. And most of the people, it was called the Tahoe Brigade. And most of the people were folks. Well, so there was about three different kinds of folks. One was people who had fought forest fires before, you know, the hardcore Forest Service kind of people, but young men, because this was a pickup crew. And then there was the people who lived on the river. The Yuba River was a lovely place in California, and there was folks who just went out there and camped out all summer long. And so there was a bunch of them. The Forest Service guys called them the hippies, but that's okay. And then there were a few women who came up from Sacramento, and the reason it happened is one of the guys who lived on the river happened to be down in Sacramento and was talking to some people and talking excitedly about what he was going to do. And they said, oh, gee, would they let girls on? And he said, women are always welcome where I am. And so the women came up, and some of them didn't quite make it. The woman who was smoking so heavily. So she didn't make it, but I did. And I got on the crew and did that for a few summers. And
it's interesting because you have to put that all into perspective. You know, if you consider it to today, it might be a commonplace thing to see female.
No, it's not.
Firefighters. No. But back then, it was a totally different scenario because you had to overcome all of these obstacles and built in prejudice against women in the firefighting, because that's a manly thing to do, you know.
Yeah, but our crew, the Tahoe Brigade, that got formed, we formed ourselves. And so we had a lot of free-thinking men, the guys who were camped out on the river, and women. And then, you know, and a few other folks that got persuaded, yeah, this is going to be okay. But it was not common at all. Our crew was the only crew that I knew of that had women on it at that time. I mean, like we were the first.
I just find it very interesting that you go pretty much where your whims take you, but they're usually, I don't know if the interest precedes the whim or the whim precedes the interest, because I'm just looking at the things that you've done and you're doing, and I can tell a lot by looking what's in the bookcase behind you. By the way, that's always a dead giveaway, because I can see animals, earth, the elements being well represented there, flowers, plants, pictures of birds. So that gives you a little insight. All of these things, did they come to you as a whim, or did you just fall into it in your 6 degrees of separation?
Whim is not a word I would use, but it's an interest. How shall I say this? All right. So I was looking for work. I found the firefighters. All right. That's cool. That just happened. It just happened. Maybe somebody planned it, but I didn't. And then when I was fighting forest fires on the Tahoe Brigade, and then the next summer, next spring, before summer came around, I got a call from somebody who said, we're forming a new crew here in Davis. And that's because the coffee house, student-run coffee house, was going to be open all summer. And then all of a sudden, the university said, nope, we're going to close that building. So, okay. So they had a whole bunch of people suddenly out of work. One of them had fought forest fires and said, we'll just make up a team. We'll make up a crew. And, you know, I'll be the crew leader because I've had the most experience. Everybody else had no experience. And we'll just be a team. And so he called me and he asked me if I could be on that crew because I had a little more experience. Okay, a crew. That's wonderful. Be out of Davis. That was great. I wouldn't have to drive up to Grass Valley to catch the bus. I'd just catch the bus here. I love it. Sure. Okay, I'll do that. And as things progressed and we were going to get started, and there was a couple of people who had a little bit of experience, and then me, and then one other person who was gung-ho, but he hadn't actually done it before. And then and I said, so how many people on crew? And he said, well, we've got 19. There's three squads of six each, that's 18, and the crew leader, that's 19. And I said, yeah, but how many people do you have going to be trained to be on the crew? 19. I said, that won't work. What if somebody's sick? What if somebody's out of town? You can't kill a whole crew just because one person's gone, but they won't take you if you don't have 19 on the bus. So you really better get more people. Okay, so we'll have another meeting over on campus at the coffee house, and we'll announce it and encourage people to come, and we'll get a few more people. And that's good, because you should always have more than enough. All right. So this is fine. This is going along. Next, I got a phone call saying, will you be a quad leader? Well, sure. I've never done that before, but I can organize things. I haven't organized. Sure, I'll do that. And then I got another phone call the night before the event, and saying, so-and-so, the fellow who had experience and was going to be the crew leader, has gone. He got a job and he left. The fellow who had who was going to be one of the other squad leaders didn't pass the eye exam. You can't wear contact lenses out in smoke. It doesn't work. And he couldn't get his eyes to an acceptable level just with glasses. So he's out. And the third guy, who had experience, he was in the Navy, and at one point there was an island that had a fire on it, and so the Navy sent some people in to fight the forest fire on the island. That was experience. That was it. But he was still down in Southern California. He hadn't arrived yet. So they said, Lois, you've got the most experience. Will you be the crew leader? And I'm going, what? What? I had not even been a squad leader before, but all of a sudden I have the most experience. That is scary. That is so scary. But I thought about it for a minute and I said, sure. So here I was going into a meeting where we're trying to get more people to come and fight forest fires because we need more than 19 and we just lost a couple. And here I am sitting up in front going, well, we're going to be a fire crew.
So how long did that career last for you?
3 summers.
Wow, that's a long time.
The fire crew it's an AD crew for the Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service. And what you do is you all go, you get trained, you get a little green card, red card, and then you can go and you have authorization to go and work on a fire. And the crew organizes itself internally. And then when a call comes in, and we had a dedicated number to get the call from, and when the call comes in, then everybody gets a paged. We had little beepers, little pagers, and gets paged. And then we'd meet up. We'd get our gear together, and we'd meet up at a certain meeting place, and they'd send a bus down to come and get us. Sounds really simple and straightforward. The only problem was that summer was so hot and dry, and things started burning so early, we couldn't get trained because the trainers were all out fighting fires. So by the time we got trained, it was like into fire season already. And so we get called out a few times. We didn't get much experience because it was so late in the season. But anyway, it was interesting. And then the next year, we ended up with more people, and so we had two crews. I mean, it was still Davis Fire Crew, but we had enough people to field two crews at the time. By the third year, we had several crews that could go out. And so when they'd call, we'd field several crews. And by that point, there were women on all the crews, women crew leaders, women squad leaders. You know, it was fine. That was a few years in. The first time that I went out on a fire, this was with Tahoe Brigade, and I was just one of, I guess there were probably 4 or 6 of us women on the crew, and the rest were guys. Excuse me, the rest were men. We went there, we worked, we were, you know, we went in camp, we got food, we did the normal stuff, we had sleeping bags, we you know, were camping out, everything was fine. They, after a few days, set up a shower so that you could actually get clean, which was a wonderful thing. But they set it up and they had just, you know, the stands with the shower, no curtains or anything. No, you weren't inside all the time. You were out in the shower room. You went inside and you changed you took your clothes off and you packed them up and stuff. Then you went out and there was the shower out there. And there was a fence around the enclosure so that it was, you know, didn't have people trooping through the middle of the shower, but the fence was only about waist high, chest high, something like that. So here we are, 6 women, and I don't know how many hundred men, because all the other crews were male, of course. We were the only one that had women on the crew. And so we thought about it and we said, okay, we'll go last. And that way, all those other guys, they'll be out of there. Our men will go in when the other people are still there and, you know, work their way out. So by the time the women were going in, the only people in that shower area would be our guys. And that was fine. I mean, we were comfortable with each other. I mean, heck, you know, skinny dipping and all that stuff. We weren't worried about it. We should have been worried about it. So what happened is we did that. Our guys were in, they went in the shower, they got out at the end. And when the women were showering, all of a sudden, all the other men from all the other, not all, I can't say all, I don't know if it was all, hundreds came and gathered around to ogle us we're standing there trying to get clean. And this, and the thing that made me mad was that our liaison with the Forest Service did not come and say, okay, enough, go, you know, break it up. Didn't say anything.
It was easier for them to ignore it than it was to deal with the politics. And
well, it was at the moment, but that incident changed how the Forest Service dealt with things. And I say not for the better. I mean, I think it would have been better if they just said, okay, break it up and go away and let the ladies, you know, get clean. But no, because the Forest Service was I don't know why they did it. I can't say it was because they were afraid of lawsuits, or I can't say it was because it was a national policy or whatever. But anyway, the next time that we were doing things like that, there were enclosed showers and they scheduled them so that here's the men's time and here's the women's time. And it was like, it was ridiculous. I mean, there's only three showers. All you have to do is, you know, clear out one of them. We're good. But so, it changed.
So the timing was, what year was this?
That was in the late 70s, 76, 79, you know.
70s. Well, let's say that it wasn't an enlightened age for men, especially if they're a little bit chauvinistic. They still acted like children.
I disagree. I think it was that social mores were changing, and depending upon who you were and where you were, things changed faster in some places than others. For example, if you were on a college campus, you knew that the women on the campus were not going to put up with certain things. You know, you learned that. If you were a man on the campus, the women on the campus will teach you. You know, you cannot do that. No, you'll get in trouble if you say that to me. No, don't call her that. You know, but off campus, it didn't spread quite as fast. And so the men on the other crews were generally not from college campuses. They hadn't gotten the message yet. So I don't blame them for doing what they'd always done. It was embarrassing. I was annoyed. But, you know, it took them a little while longer to learn, but that's okay. They'll learn eventually.
So you were on the sharp end of the feminist movement to educate people that this is not good behavior. Is that what you're basically?
Well, what I'm saying is that if someone was offensive, I would probably tell them that it was offensive.
Good for you.
Sometimes it wasn't safe to do, and I wouldn't say anything. But if it was safe, I'd tell them.
But it's a very interesting story, and it's an enlightenment about your personality, because I think to this day you would accomplish the same thing by being equally vocal about something that was a miscarriage of justice or somebody who's doing stupid things like ogling or something like that. Even in this world we live in today, we're finding out that some lessons are hard fought and hard won. And maybe you fought them a little bit harder than others, you know, leading the way. But how did firefighting lead you into another career? Not to shift gears so much, but what was your next career in your life?
Well, firefighting wasn't really a career. It was a summer thing. I was at the university, and my brother was much smarter than me. And so he went off to Vietnam, and when he came back, and he was a National Merit Scholar. I mean, he was brilliant. And when he came back, they had changed the rules. So if you were drafted, you could be gone for 2.5 years and keep your scholarship. So if you were drafted, you'd get your scholarship when you came back. If you volunteered, that was a 3-year commitment, and you would not get your scholarship when you came back, which I thought was very, very unfair of them. So my brother came back from Vietnam. He did not anymore have a scholarship, and he had been going to this very prestigious school in Kalamazoo in Michigan, very, very prestigious because he had a full scholarship. But anyway, so I would go to school, and then I'd drop out and work. I'd go to school, I'd drop out and work. And I, because it was, I wasn't a feminist yet, it was more important that my brother get a college degree because, after all, I'm just going to get married and have kids, and it's okay. It does not lack, not sound like me, does it?
It says sarcastically.
So I was in and out of college. And I was working, I worked as in the office of the dining hall or did this or did that. And then by that time, I had the bookstore. So the bookstore didn't pay anything, but it was there. And I was still going to college. And I'd work to get my money to go to college and stuff like that. My next real job came after I became a Quaker. And I joined the Quakers here in Davis. And then I found out about the Friends Committee on Legislation of California, which is the lobbying group for the Quakers. And so I ended up going over there and getting and working there. So I was office manager. It was a tandem position. It was very, everything I've done has been very experimental. It's like at that time, you didn't just take a position and break it up into two so that you could have two people working at it part-time because that way they could have a family. No. You guys had to work full-time and women had to, no, ain't going to work, ain't going to fly. So that's what I did next is I worked for a Friends Committee on Legislation of California for several years, and I overworked. I ended up with a lot of comp time coming that I hadn't taken yet. And then they reorganized the place, and suddenly my position wasn't there anymore. But I had 3 months of comp time coming. So I had 3 months where I didn't have to work. And you know, it was the very first time in my life that I had not been going to something. Every other time I was going to something, and so I let go of the previous thing. This time, all of a sudden, here I am with no work, you know? And so I tried to figure out what should I do? What do I want to do? I sat down and I looked at every job I'd ever had, and I wrote down what I liked about it and what I didn't like about it. And then I went and I wrote down all the things that I enjoyed doing, even if I hadn't been paid for them. And then I looked at all of my lists and said, okay, well, I definitely don't want to do this, this, or this. Oh, there's a whole big, long list of things that I might do. And I thought about it, and I realized that what I did not want to do was the same thing 40 hours a week. I did not want to be at the same work all the time. And so I said, well, I guess I'll just make up my own business. I called it The Organizer, and I started, you know, figuring out what I could do for people. And I wrote up a little brochure and stuff. Before that, I had been helping my ex-mother-in-law to do stuff around the house, doing her paperwork for her and stuff. She had moved to Davis from the East Coast and she was so far behind. I'm so out of doing paperwork that, like, they had declared her dead because she hadn't cashed her checks, you know, Social Security checks for so long. Anyway, so I was helping her, and she was paying me, and I thought, well, gee, if I can have that, I just get a few more clients, I'll be fine. And so I did.
So have you ever had an inkling to go into a certain job or interview, and you got completely shot down? Did that ever happen to you, and how did you handle that?
If it happened to me, I don't remember it. I tend not to remember bad things.
Okay. Well, that's a fair answer. I'm very interested in how this all led to where you are now, and it's actually becoming clearer and clearer.
It didn't.
Well, it's like you decide you want to do something, you do it. And it's like this, you know, a little thing like feminism's not going to stop you. A little thing like having a job somewhere where you don't want to work 40 hours a week didn't stop you. So does that explain all of your varied interest that's going on today?
I'm not sure, really. Here's a good example. I've been a photographer ever since I was a kid, but I never considered it art. I just took pictures. And then somebody was talking about something else. And then my husband was gone for a while. My current husband, Jim Drummond. And he was back east. He was stationed there. And so my clients were one-on-one for the organizer. And so I wasn't getting any social action. So I went to the local community center. It's called Davis Senior Center. And I started going to a little art class because there I could meet some people. And I, you know, and so I did that. And from then on... And now I do consider myself an artist. But from then on, when I would see something that someone had done that I would admire, I go, oh, that's really cool. What's that called? Well, that's called block printing. Okay, well, maybe I'll go and I'll take a little class at the university in their craft center and I'll take a class on block printing and I'll do a block print. Okay, or some class would come up and there was a class on encaustics. What the heck is encaustics? Well, it's wax and resin and pigment all mixed together, melted, and you put it in a pot, and you end up with all these colors in a pots, and they're all liquid, and you can, like, paint with them, or you can pour them, or you can... Ooh, that sounds neat. So I went and took a class. I enjoyed it so much. I went and took another class. I enjoyed that so much. I tried to take a third class, but by then she had moved someplace else, so I went over there, and I took her class. I didn't ever set up my own caustic studio because it is so expensive. Not only have to buy all the encaustic paints, but you also have to have all these like heating pads. And I was it's a lot to set it up. So I just will be taking classes from her anytime she offers one, and I will make encaustics. And I've made a whole bunch of encaustics. But that's what happens is I see something and I go, ooh, and I go and learn how to do it. Or I'll see something and it will inspire me to try something else. I went to a little workshop and we were supposed to paint on wood and then drill a couple holes in it and have a little bit of wire, you know, hanging around, just, you know, a little spiral or something like that. Well, I'm slow. I didn't get it finished. I took it home. And so I, instead of just a little heart or something, I just started writing words in wire and sticking them on the paint. Well, if I can write a word in wire, I can make anything in wire. So I started doing wire sculptures. Really, I mean, I just sort of made it up, you know? I forget what they were doing. But anyway, I found some aluminum repair tape in the garage. And I thought, that's awfully soft. I wonder if I can draw on it and make lines that you can see, and I could. So that means I can emboss it. And then I could put, acrylic paint to fill in the little holes and the little lines and stuff. And then I could color it with this or with that. Now if I could take it off of there and put it on. So I ended up with a whole different technique that I've never seen anybody else do just because I started playing. And that's what happens to me is I'll see something and go, gee, I wonder what I could do with that.
How did that take you to social media and broadcasting?
I'm not in social media and I don't do broadcasting.
Okay. I'm not sure what it is that you do, but whatever it is that we're doing right now.
Okay, so television show, radio show, when the pandemic hit and I had to learn how to do Zoom. And then, of course, as soon as I learn something, I start teaching it. So I was teaching people in the community how to do Zoom, how to get on. And then I was looking for a place where I could practice some of the things that you can't do with one or two people. And I came across this other fellow who had also been doing that. And he had started a little practice group called the Zoom Test Kitchen. And so I went in there and started practicing and whatever. And so I've been in his thing since, well, really early on. And so I was in the Zoom test kitchen for months. And several somebodies kept saying, oh, you really need to come over to office hours. You really need to come over to office hours. Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah, sure. I finally did. I got hooked. And so office hours and after hours. And okay. So, you know, we're trying to do too many things. I've been an Arboretum docent for 20 plus years. And about 10 years ago, I said, why don't you do programs in the wintertime? Even if it's cold and wet and rainy and we can't go outside, surely there's something that could be done inside. And they said, okay, Lois, what are you going to do? So I started doing a winter birds in Davis. And I did slideshow and we'd go out and look at birds and stuff. And that slideshow, I was going to try and improve a little bit. Because, you know, I've been doing the same thing pretty much. When the pandemic came, it was easy. I just did it on Zoom instead of doing it in the classroom. It was easy. But I wanted to up the game a little bit. I managed to mention that in December in After Hours. And all these people jumped on it and said, ooh, a new project. We'll do a birding project. And it has now, become Birding with Lois, a weekly streamed to YouTube live question and answer show with panelists and your host, Lois Richter.
But you found an outlet for your interest, and that outlet you could share with people all over the world for that matter. And you're doing it very well.
But the whole social media thing is not mine. That's other people saying, oh, we'll use YouTube. Oh, you should do this. Have a Facebook page, have a Twitter or whatever it is. That other people said I should do that. And I'm trying to do this big birding project, and managing that is really tough. It's there's so many moving parts. But I can learn new things, and I do.
Right. So you're saying that you were dragged into this medium of broadcasting?
I don't think so. I mean, radio, television, that makes perfect sense to me. You know, back in the 90s, before the internet had the World Wide Web, it was just email. And then eventually there was this, you could do FTP, File Transfer Protocol, FTP, but you had to know exact file name and exact location to the directory on the computer. I mean, you had to know it precisely in order to get this thing. And somebody came up with a gopher. And what it was you would go to a page, and now instead of having to know the exact string to get you to that file, you could come into a page and they'd say, number one is this thing, number two is this thing, number three. And I could just go, oh, number three is what I want. And I was there. It was wonderful. It made life so much simpler. But within a few months, someone had gone, you know, if we can have a list, why can't we embed that list in a text? And then you could read a bunch of stuff and then click on the link. Wouldn't that be nice? Okay. Oh, we could add pictures. The next thing you know, we've got the World Wide Web. Yeah. So it was a very quick shift.
That was the beginning of markup language that allowed that to happen. And that's sort of, you know, we've left that in the weeds, so to speak.
Oh, no. Oh, no. HTML is still quite active and quite useful.
We've extended that well into CSS and other things.
There's lots of more stuff. Yeah. But at that point, there was nothing.
Sure.
Now, at the point that the World Wide Web started up, well, people needed to learn how to do that. So I did classes on it. I don't know anything about it. We just made it up. Years later, people would say, oh, how do you know all this stuff? And I said, we just made it up.
Sure.
You know, we made it up.
So one more question for you before we have to go. What's next, Lois?
Sleep. Yeah.
A lot of it.
And then I want to get back into doing artwork. I haven't done any artwork for about almost 2 years, just because the pandemic came and then there was so much to do to help people get through it, you know, to learn Zoom and all that other stuff. And then now the birding project is taking up so much time. And if any of you listeners out there know anyone who would like to be a panelist, please let them contact me. My email address is birdingwithlois@gmail.com.
Well, you know what they say, Lois, that's life and that's program. And thank you very much for being your own guest on your own show here on KDRT. And I think it's a pleasure for me to be able to interview it, even though I still feel we got just a tiny sliver of your life leading to this. But all of it very interesting. I love the idea that you're one of the original feminists that allowed you to bring yourself to where you are today. I count you as an excellent friend, and I appreciate what you're about, especially since I'm an old radio DJ, and I know that you tolerate my existence sometimes, but for the most part, you've educated me, and that's what really it's all about.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch, for being my guest host today. And you all have been listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California.
Yeah, I think you got a good hour out of that.
Oh, yeah, just about.
Interesting story. Do you feel that we covered what you wanted to cover?
I had no plan.
Okay.
I had a good time. I had to talk really fast to get some of that stuff in there, and we didn't mention a lot of things. So there's a lot of other stuff.
But we mentioned things that make you who you are today.
Yeah.
That's important.
Well, I believe that everything you've done makes you who you are today.
Yeah, that's true. You're a product of your environment. Are you a B.F. Skinner follower?
No, I'm not a follower of anything, by the way. I mean, I'll have a painting and someone will say, oh, you're painting in the style of XYZ. And I'm going, I have no idea who XYZ is and I am not following them.
So, I don't know. I'm seeing a little Van Gogh in there behind you in some of your paintings.
Are you talking about that one?
Uh-huh.
That's just drawing circles with crystals.
It's just a coincidence, Mitch. So get over it.
It's a coincidence, Mitch.
Thank you very much, Lois. I appreciate it. And as always, I look forward to seeing you on the office hours. I think you're a real asset to that. And you bring a perspective, whether it's what led you to where you are today. But you don't ask the typical questions. That's what I'll say. You don't answer them in a typical fashion.
Oh, no. If I knew the answer to a typical question, I wouldn't bother asking it.
Exactly. Exactly. Because, you know, sometimes, and I'll finish with it, but sometimes those guys will go off on some tangent. They're talking about the FY Phantom 3 and how it's 70 millimeters more than it. And I'm sitting there scratching my head. I have no idea what they're talking about. And I'm not sure I want to admit that I don't. And there you come in there with a question. And I'm like,
and what's that? What's a Phantom what?
Yeah, exactly.
I think this is something that in the culture of our time, you and I, that guys were taught that you had to know everything. You couldn't ask for help. You couldn't. That whole joke about asking for directions, you know, in some ways that was typical at that time. I don't think it is now. I think things have changed. But yeah. So if you ever have a question you want to ask, but you don't want to let people know you don't know the answer, just tell me. I'll ask it for you.
I just put a disclaimer and say, you know, I feel like an idiot asking this, but Alex, what the heck is a Phantom 9, you know? And I know I've never gotten a rejection because of that. So you shouldn't be afraid to say that.
Oh, I'm not afraid. But I would never say, I may sound like an idiot asking this. Anyway, I'm done. Well, I've been on since, what, 6 this morning or something?
And when I get off with you, I'm going to take a nap.
Well, that's a good plan. You are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California.